A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking for a clear-eyed primer aimed at non-Americans, tracing how immigration went from a relatively boring bipartisan issue to one of the great lightning rods of American politics. He wants the demographic and economic forces that drove the shift, then the story of how ICE emerged, literally created out of the post-9/11 Homeland Security reorganization, and why it generates the heat it does. From there, the January 6th Capitol Hill riot, what actually happened and what the prosecutions revealed, and then a question that genuinely puzzles a lot of outsiders. Does the US really allow private citizens to form armed militias? What's the actual legal line?
That is a full plate. And you know, these four things connect in a way that isn't obvious at first glance. They're all about who gets to enforce the law and who gets to defy it. The same questions about state power run through all of them.
Before we dive in, quick note. DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today, so if anything sounds unusually coherent, that's why.
Pressure's on, DeepSeek. Alright, let's start with the immigration arc, because that's the foundation everything else sits on. And the thing most people outside the US don't realize is how recently this became a partisan war. For decades, immigration was the one thing Republicans and Democrats broadly agreed on. Reagan signed the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act, Amnesty, for about 3 million undocumented immigrants, plus employer penalties. Bush expanded legal immigration in 1990. Bush proposed a temporary worker program with a path to legal status. These were Republican presidents.
Because something clearly did.
Two things happened simultaneously. The first is demographic. The foreign-born share of the U.S. population nearly doubled from 9% in 1990 to 15% in 2020. By 2020, there were 62 million Hispanic or Latino residents, a 23% increase from 2010, and that group accounted for over half of all U.S. population growth in that decade. The country was changing, visibly, and faster than a lot of people were comfortable with.
The second thing?
The Tea Party. 2010 is the real inflection point. The Tea Party introduced a populist, anti-immigration strain into Republican politics that directly challenged the party's business-friendly, pro-immigration wing. The Chamber of Commerce types wanted cheap labor and expanded visa programs. The Tea Party base wanted a wall. That internal fight is what reshaped the GOP, and Trump was the beneficiary.
It's worth noting that the actual numbers don't fully explain the intensity of the politics. The foreign-born share of the population actually declined slightly from its 2023 historic high of 15.8% to 14.8% in 2024. So immigration politics have never been more heated, even as the demographic trend line flattened out. The gap between perception and reality is part of the story.
Trump exploited that gap masterfully. He made immigration the central culture war issue. The wall, the Muslim ban, the zero-tolerance policy that produced family separations at the border. And here's the counterintuitive part, public opinion actually shifted leftward in response. By 2020, more Americans favored increased immigration than before Trump took office. The backlash created its own backlash.
Which then set the stage for what came after. Biden reversed a lot of Trump policies, halted wall construction, ended the Muslim ban, expanded parole programs. The CHNV program alone covered about 1.7 million people. But the media focus on border crossings eroded support for his approach, and by the time Trump returned to office in January 2025, he came back with a mass deportation agenda framed explicitly in invasion language.
That brings us to ICE, which is where things get really concrete. Most people don't realize ICE is a young agency. It was created on March 1, 2003 under the Homeland Security Act, signed by George W. Act. The law merged functions from 22 different agencies and dissolved the old Immigration and Naturalization Service, the INS. Immigration enforcement moved from the Justice Department to the brand new Department of Homeland Security. The framing was deliberate. Immigration was now a national security issue.
Post-9/11 logic.
The 9/11 hijackers had exploited immigration loopholes, and the response was to treat immigration enforcement as counterterrorism. That framing has shaped everything ICE has done since.
Walk me through the growth, because my sense is the budget numbers tell a story.
They absolutely do. ICE's budget in fiscal year 2003 was about $3.5 billion adjusted for inflation. By fiscal year 2024, it was $9.99 billion. That's a 185% increase, more than double the overall growth rate of federal spending in the same period. And then came the 2025 One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which allocated $28.7 billion for ICE in fiscal year 2025 alone, nearly triple the prior year, $75 billion over 4 years.
That's not incremental growth. That's a fundamental reorientation of what the agency is.
It's not just money. ICE has hired over 12,000 new agents since January 2025, expanding its headcount to over 22,000. Recruits get $50,000 signing bonuses and student loan forgiveness. The age limit was dropped from 21 to 18. The 37-year hiring cap was waived entirely. This is where it gets alarming. The ICE Academy was shortened from 22 weeks to 47 days. The number 47 was reportedly chosen because Trump is the 47th president, which is a strange way to design law enforcement training. Spanish language training was removed entirely. Agents are told to use mobile translation apps. And police officers being deputized to work with ICE need only a 40-hour online course.
You have agents with 7 weeks of training, no language skills, armed and conducting raids. What could go wrong?
Quite a lot, as it turns out. 32 people died in ICE custody in 2025. About one-third of those arrested have no criminal record. ICE has deported roughly 540,000 people since January 2025. And then there are the killings of U.S. citizens. On January 7, 2026, ICE agent Jonathan Ross shot and killed Renee Nicole Good, a 37-year-old American mother in Minneapolis. It was ruled a homicide. On January 24, Alex Pretty, a 37-year-old ICU nurse, was shot dead by an ICE agent. Multiple videos appear to show him unarmed and being subdued.
The accountability question.
The Trump administration has argued for absolute immunity for ICE officers. Not qualified immunity, which is the standard for most law enforcement, but absolute immunity, which would block lawsuits even when agents knowingly violate clearly established law. A federal judge in Minnesota had to explicitly restate that peaceful protesters cannot be retaliated against. And yet 60% of Americans believe ICE uses excessive force, according to a YouGov poll.
The tactics themselves are where the heat comes from. Workplace raids have escalated dramatically. Factories, garment districts, farms, restaurants, masked agents in tactical gear, unmarked vans, smashed car windows, courthouse arrests, school arrests. In January 2026, a 5-year-old with a pending asylum case was apprehended as he arrived home from preschool. School officials said he was used as bait.
U.S. citizens have been detained based on accent or appearance, including Native Americans. The racial profiling dimension is not subtle. So when critics describe ICE as a pinup poster for state-sanctioned harassment, this is the context. It's not hyperbole. There's a documented pattern.
Let's pivot to January 6th. Because that connects directly to the question of who gets to use force and against whom. And the contrast between how the state responded to January 6th versus how it conducts immigration enforcement is, I think, part of what Daniel is gesturing toward.
So January 6th, 2021. A mob of Trump supporters storms the U.S. Capitol to disrupt the certification of Biden's electoral victory. About 140 police officers were injured. Cracked ribs, smashed spinal discs, brain injuries. Multiple officers died by suicide in the weeks afterward. The Department of Justice investigation was the largest criminal investigation in U.S. history, involving over 5,000 FBI employees. The Justice Department convicted more than 1,000 defendants before the pardons. Prosecutors won convictions in 100% of jury trials. That's an extraordinary statistic. When these cases went to a jury, the evidence was so overwhelming that not a single defendant was acquitted.
Who were they? Because the profile is not what a lot of people assume.
Predominantly white, 86 to 90%, and male, 86%. Average age, about 41. They came from 40 to 47 states. Nearly 60% had significant financial problems. 18% had declared bankruptcy, which is double the national rate. 20% had faced eviction or foreclosure. 25% had been sued by creditors. About one-third had ties to extremist groups, Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters. At least 27 had prior criminal records, including 9 with violence against women convictions.
The profile is not hardened terrorists. It's financially struggling, middle-aged, mostly white Americans who got radicalized. That's in some ways more unsettling than if they were all card-carrying extremists. It suggests a broader vulnerability.
George Washington University's program on extremism did a detailed assessment of the participants, and that's exactly their conclusion. These were ordinary people who got pulled into something extraordinary, which complicates both the lone wolf terrorist narrative and the political prisoner narrative.
Then came the pardons. January 20th, 2025. Trump's first day back in office. Blanket pardons and commutations for nearly 1,600 defendants. The federal prosecutions ended. Trump has since referred to defendants as hostages, claimed most were absolutely innocent, and described assaults on police as very minor incidents.
Claims that are directly contradicted by court records, guilty pleas, and that 100% conviction rate at trial. You don't plead guilty to assaulting a police officer if the assault was very minor and didn't happen. And 5 years later, the basic facts of January 6th remain politically contested. House Democrats held a public meeting on January 6, 2026, to rebut what they call a rewriting of history. The facts are not settled in the public mind, even though they were settled in court.
Which brings us to the militia question. Because some of the January 6th defendants were militia members, and for outsiders, the idea that the United States just lets private citizens form armed paramilitary groups is baffling.
The answer is, it doesn't. Let's walk through the actual law. The Second Amendment says, a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. For most of American history, that was understood as protecting state-based citizen militias as a check on federal standing armies. The idea was that the federal government shouldn't have a monopoly on force. Radically, in 2008, District of Columbia versus Heller. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to possess firearms for self-defense, independent of any militia service. But the court also explicitly affirmed that gun regulation is as much a part of the Second Amendment as the right to keep and bear arms. The individual right is not unlimited.
What about private militias specifically?
Federal law, Title 10 of the U.S. Code, Sections 246 through 255, defines the militia as two things, the organized militia, which is the National Guard, and the unorganized militia, which is all able-bodied males 17 to 45. Private militias have no legal standing under this framework. And the Supreme Court held in Presser v. Illinois way back in 1896 that the Second Amendment does not protect private paramilitary organizations from being outlawed by states.
All 50 states ban private militias.
California's Penal Code Section 11,460 defines a private paramilitary as two or more persons assembling for the purpose of practicing with weapons and engaging in combat training. Violations can carry up to 1 year in prison, and yet these laws are rarely enforced.
That's the gap. The law on paper versus the law in practice.
It's enormous. It is not technically illegal merely to be a member of an armed extremist militia. Law enforcement struggles to prove that activities like meeting, training, and carrying arms meet the legal threshold for criminal charges. So groups like the Three Percenters, the Oath Keepers, and local patriot militias engage in combat scenario training, field exercises, firearms proficiency drills, roadblock simulations, close-quarter combat, often on public lands, and they're operating in this gray zone where the activity looks illegal but proving it in court is extremely difficult.
Several of their members were convicted in connection with January 6th, so the connection between militia activity and political violence is not theoretical.
It's not. And that's the thread that runs through all four of these topics. Immigration enforcement went from a bureaucratic function to a culture war battleground because the state started using force more visibly and more aggressively. ICE became the face of that force. January 6th was a direct challenge to the state's monopoly on legitimate force. and the militia question is about who gets to organize private force outside the state's control. It's all the same question from different angles.
One thing I want to pull on, you mentioned the 47-day training academy. That number was reportedly chosen because Trump is the 47th president. Is that confirmed or is that a rumor that got legs?
It's been reported by Brookings and multiple other outlets, and the administration hasn't denied it. The symbolism is the point. Shortening training from 22 weeks to 47 days is not an operational decision. It's a political statement. And when you combine that with eliminating Spanish language training and telling agents to use phone translation apps, you're making a deliberate choice about what kind of agency ICE is going to be.
The ICE expansion also raises a question about institutional inertia. Once you build an agency with a $28 billion budget and 22,000 agents, it doesn't shrink back down easily. Whoever is in the White House next inherits that infrastructure.
And that's why the budget trajectory matters. The $75 billion over 4 years isn't just about enforcement. It's about building a permanent deportation infrastructure that will outlast any single administration. The Brennan Center has called it a deportation industrial complex, and the parallel to the military industrial complex is intentional. Once the contracts are signed and the detention centers are built and the agent pipeline is filled, reversing course becomes politically and logistically extremely difficult.
Let's go back to January 6 for a moment. The 100% conviction rate at trial is striking. What does that tell us?
It tells us the evidence was overwhelming. These weren't closed cases. When the government has video footage of you inside the Capitol, your own social media posts bragging about it, and sometimes your own selfie videos from inside the building, there's not a lot of room for reasonable doubt. The 100% conviction rate isn't a sign of prosecutorial overreach. It's a sign that the cases were strong. Yet the pardons happened anyway. Which is why the basic facts are still contested. You have a situation where the legal system reached a definitive conclusion, and then the political system essentially overruled it. That's not supposed to happen in a democracy, or at least it's supposed to be extraordinary. Here it was wholesale.
The militia piece is what I think will surprise a lot of non-American listeners the most. The idea that all 50 states ban private militias, the Supreme Court has said they're not protected, and yet they operate openly, and the laws are almost never enforced. That's a pretty fundamental failure of the rule of law.
And it's not a failure of the law itself. The laws are on the books and they're clear. It's a failure of enforcement. Law enforcement agencies have to make choices about where to allocate resources, and for decades, prosecuting militia members for training activities that haven't yet resulted in violence was not a priority. After January 6th, that calculus may shift, but the pattern is well established.
There's also a First Amendment dimension here, right? The line between a group of friends who like guns and camping and a paramilitary organization conducting combat training can be blurry, and prosecutors have to be careful not to criminalize association.
That's exactly the legal challenge. The Supreme Court has been very protective of freedom of association. Mere membership in a group, even a group with ugly views, is protected. What's not protected is conspiracy to commit violence, or actual paramilitary training directed toward unlawful ends. Proving that line has been crossed requires evidence that is often hard to get before something bad happens.
You have a system that is structurally reactive rather than proactive. You can prosecute after the violence happens, after January 6th, but stopping the training and organization before it becomes violence is much harder.
That's the tension. In a liberal democracy, we don't want pre-crime enforcement. We don't want the state shutting down groups because of what they might do, but that means we accept some level of risk that organized private violence will emerge. The question is whether that risk is being managed responsibly, and I think the evidence from January 6th suggests it wasn't.
Let's circle back to the immigration arc for a moment, because there's an interesting demographic paradox we touched on. The foreign-born share of the population actually declined slightly, and yet the politics are more intense than ever. What explains that?
Part of it is media. The images people see, caravans at the border, overcrowded detention facilities, and now masked ICE agents in tactical gear. Those images drive perception more than aggregate statistics do. If the foreign-born share drops from 15.8% to 14.8%, nobody feels that in their daily life. But if you see constant coverage of border crossings, you feel like something is happening.
The media incentives cut both ways. Outlets that want to drive engagement know that immigration footage generates strong emotional responses, so the coverage is disproportionate to the statistical reality.
There's also a geographic dimension. Immigration is not evenly distributed. Some communities experience very rapid demographic change, and those communities become flashpoints. The national numbers don't capture the local experience.
One more thing on ICE before we move to practical takeaways. The absolute immunity argument, is that likely to hold up in court?
It's a radical departure from existing law. Qualified immunity already makes it very difficult to sue federal officers. You have to show they violated clearly established law. Absolute immunity would mean you can't sue even if they did. It's the standard that applies to judges and prosecutors, not to law enforcement officers conducting raids. I think the courts will be very skeptical. But the fact that the administration is even arguing for it tells you something about how they view accountability.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Octopuses have 3 hearts, and 2 of them stop beating when they swim.
For listeners trying to make sense of all this, where should they focus? What actually matters for understanding these issues?
I'd say 3 things. First, follow the money. The ICE budget trajectory tells you more about where immigration enforcement is going than any political speech. When an agency's budget nearly triples in a single year, that's a policy choice with concrete consequences. Second, pay attention to training standards. The 47-day academy and the elimination of language training are not details. They're decisions that directly shape how agents behave in the field. And third, understand the gap between law and enforcement. The militia question is the clearest example. The laws exist, but they're not enforced. That gap is where a lot of American political dysfunction lives.
I'd add, look at the demographics skeptically. The intensity of political conflict doesn't always match the statistical reality. When you hear invasion language, check the actual numbers. The foreign-born share of the population is not skyrocketing. That doesn't mean there aren't real challenges, but it does mean the rhetoric is doing work that the data doesn't support.
On January 6th, the thing to hold on to is that the legal system worked. It investigated, it prosecuted, it convicted, and then the political system intervened. That sequence matters. The rule of law produced a result, and then democracy produced a different result. How you feel about that probably depends on your politics, but understanding that both things happened is essential.
The militia question is the one that I think will stick with a lot of listeners, because it's so counterintuitive. The U.S. has clear laws banning private paramilitaries. The Supreme Court has said the Second Amendment doesn't protect them, and yet they exist. They train openly, and the laws sit on the shelf. That's not a legal problem. It's an enforcement problem. And enforcement problems are political problems.
Which brings us back to where we started. All 4 of these topics are about the same thing: who gets to use force, when, and against whom. Immigration enforcement, the Capitol riot, private militias. They're all debates about the boundaries of state power and the legitimacy of private violence. That's why they generate so much heat. They're not policy disagreements. They're arguments about the nature of the state itself.
One forward-looking thought. The ICE expansion is building infrastructure that will shape immigration enforcement for decades. The detention centers, the agent pipeline, the legal precedents, all of that outlasts any administration. So the question for the next decade isn't really about Trump or Biden or whoever comes next. It's about whether the U.S. wants a large permanent deportation apparatus and what kind of accountability comes with it.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping this show running. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at My Weird Prompts.
If you got something out of this one, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more than you'd think.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head,
send it in. We'll chase the thread. My weird thoughts, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird.